first speaker is Presenteo Arts, Master. That's a good bad lip. So Theo's referred to already several times in the course of the conference, which is the roles of these fiber angle changes across the wall. We really pioneered how to think about that in a useful way, with why it's important. So we've done many things in the interval sets, so to fill us in on where we are.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. And I had it easy because you all were talking, and when you were talking, then I can change my story. That's the advantage of being late in the program. The title, that I have chosen beforehand, so I didn't change that. It's modeling of heart mechanics. And the thing is that we know the heart adapts to mechanical load, and that's affected tissue. And there are very little models which use this property. Well, in fact, it is a constitutive property of the tissue. And that's the way we want to look into these things. The group I'm currently working with is Fritz here, Tamu Delhaas, pediatric cardiologist, Peter Bovendeer, the finite element mechanical engineering, and Joost Lumens. He likes New Zealand very much, a student, and Wilco Kroon. That is the closest people of the group. When I'm talking about models, more people have talked about models already here, so I won't say too much about it, but the tools we have, let's say, more or less centrally in our group is the finite element model of the mostly mechanics of the heart and somewhat electro, where you see the contraction of the heart with left and right ventricle. And the other thing is, we found that we needed something to generate boundary conditions of hemodynamics. And then we started to make a model of the whole circulation, left and right ventricle, atria, and the circulation. And these two things are now more or less independent, but of course, there's a mutual interaction. And the whole, both models now, we are working on incorporation of adaptation, and that leads in fact to self-structuring. That means part of the model is made by the model itself. That is comparable to as the way we stand here. I mean, part of my personality is made by the environment, adaptation of me to you, and so I try to be polite, and that was okay. I adapt. This is our finite element method as developed by Roy Kerkhoffs. In fact, the geometry is stolen from I don't know whose heart, but it's out of an MRI image set. And when you push the button, it starts beating. And what you see here, in fact, is a pressure volume loop. It is really working, at least the systolic phase is really a time derivative solution. And the color here indicates red is a long sarcomere length and blue is a short sarcomere length. Left and right ventricle, it is, I think Roy Kerkhoffs did a nice job. And after he did that, then he was exported to San Diego. So. the other model is the circulation adaptation model, second that model of heart and circulation. Effect conventional, you have a heart, and blood flows in and out. Only the thing is, it's dynamic in time, so you get pressures and flows. It uses compliances, inertances, and it's nonlinear. And it adapts to the loads, because that is important. That makes up, in fact, the whole geometry of all substituting elements. That is generally a problem. When you make a model, you need parameters. And Julius knew already, he said, I have five parameters, and he already said, that's enough. Now, in fact, 5 parameters indeed is quite much already. And you try to avoid parameters. And the way we decided to do that is using the fact that we define the material properties, how much mechanical loads tissue can have, and from that we get adaptation of wall mass, fiber orientation. We also think it's determined by the mechanics. Sheet orientation has to do with the mechanics. And size and shape of blood vessels also, in fact, is determined by blood flow, which is generated by the model itself. So after a while, you can adapt the whole thing to its own situation. Again, something that I try to do quite often, but I'm not always successful in that. That means that you get an enormous reduction in parameters, because many of these properties are very much related to the material properties, and the material itself is quite uniform in many instances. Another advantage of the whole thing is that in pathology, generally, one thing changes, and then you get a response of all other secondary hypertrophy. For instance, if you have a valve leakage, you get hypertrophy. But because of the setup of this model, it generates its own hypertrophy. So I think it's quite well suited in basis for simulating adaptation to pathology, and so you can use it in diagnosis. Because generally, if a patient enters your clinic, I think, but I'm not a clinician, but generally he will be in a state of adaptation to its pathology which he suffers from. What do I mean by adaptation? Is you have cardiac function. It's in fact determined by pressure and flow load that is determined by am I resting or do I have exercise or, but let's say some average states of pressure and flow that is needed, then you can make calculations. Also in reality it happens, the tissue of the heart undergoes stress and strain, and if this stress and strain is somewhere non-standard, not the optimum, then some gene expression generally try to correct the tissue properties, the structure, the geometry of the tissue. For instance, hypertrophy is known. When something with stress or strain happens, then and it's high, you can have the result that the tissue properties in fact are growing in mass, so you get an increase of tissue mass and your pump function changes. And in fact this is a feedback loop. And in life this feedback loop generally is stable. That we hope so, and in the model it's not always stable, but it converges to a certain situation. In fact this loop is realistic, but you can also make parts of it simulate approach by some mathematical equations, and that makes up the structure of your system. First I was thinking about, let's have how we think about the myofiber structure, fiber orientation, as we have discussed a lot, and hypertrophy. More or less, these things both are linked because it's determined by the properties of the cardiac cell. And we assume that it's a result of local adaptation. How did we think about that? This is a way someone made a nice picture. It was Torlund Wass who made a nice picture. Left ventricle, right ventricle, a little bit peeled off, and you can see these fiber structures, which also are very well known from the diffusion tensor imaging and so on, but I think this picture I like because of the light. It's Spanish, some art in it. I think it's the way it's peeled off, I was because it's not always that clear how it's done. Now, our adaptation works as follows. We think the cell, the tissue, that is the center of things that happens. It's not only one cell, it might be a number of cells together forming the local tissue. And when I'm a cell, I have to make decisions. And in fact, during filling, at rest, and the SLA, I'm a cell, it's dark outside, nothing happens, and it's quite dull. But then suddenly, I feel an electric shock, so I get a signal. And then I go start to contract. But then the problem arises that the neighbors had the same idea, and they also boom. And then it's a matter of who is first, I can create signals. So, I mean, in this situation, I'm sensitive to the mechanical load increase during the increase of activation. Stretch can occur, and it occurs. I mean, when you have, for instance, a late electrical activation, it first stretches, and it's known then you get hypertrophy. It might be caused by that. And then you get a shortening, and after that you get a relaxation, and that's it. In fact, the cell doesn't know anything about what's inside, outside, up or down. It's in the middle somewhere of the heart. That is the basis of the thinking. So we program the cell and its environment, because we also have fibroblasts. No one realizes that. Let's say it's not often mentioned. Only people mention fibroblasts when they make cultures, but that they don't like it. That fibroblasts are existing. They have to do something with the extracellular matrix, I think, or we think. And you have a myocyte. What are the decisions? How do we think that they adapt? Now, we try to make a model out of it, so we think a little bit looking into the physiology, but we don't know so very much about it. But we think we can translate it in some mathematical relationships, and then we look what happened. For instance, the fiber orientation, the cell is short, can maybe rotate a little bit or change its attachment to the neighbors, and that's also a way to rearrange the tissue. Skeletal muscle is impossible. But for the heart, it's possible. And we think that the cardiac cells, the myocytes, align with the principal stress orientation. So that means when you have a curve, that will be stretched finally to a straight pathway. And also the sarcomere shortening should be in a certain range. I mean, it's known that in pathology, when a cell, a myocyte, doesn't shorten more than, let's say, in the order of a few percent, then we say the ejection fraction is low, it's not so good. It can be also too high. I mean, when you are running too fast, you get very tired of that. And it might be that your stroke volume is that big that you have to tell the heart that it should be a little bit bigger. So sarcomere shortening probably, or at least deformation, is also a signal. And that signal changes the length, the number of cells in series, or the number of sarcomeres in series. That is the way it's done. Stretch, early systolic stretch, we think that affects tissue mass. And it's known that indeed, when you stretch tissue, cardiac tissue, gene expressions are causing a kind of increase of mass. And maybe contractility in our model, that means calcium load, might also be a factor which works on increasing wall mass. Large deformations of the passive tissue matrix might disrupt some of these structures and it gets a little bit softer. It's known as strain softening, and it is an existing phenomena at least. By this case, you should think when you have a very high ejection fraction, you have large strains, and then it gets to soften. That means that the heart will dilate a little bit, and with the same stroke volume, you will get a lower strain, and in fact, that's a stable mechanism. You can put that in a model. We did it in a cylindrical model because the finite element model is 3D. One adaptation cycle took 3 hours, and if you have 1,000 adaptation cycles each time a little bit, then we have to look for someone else. I mean, I cannot wait on that. But what we did, in fact, we put this in a cylinder. The idea, we started with a fiber orientation more or less 45 degree spiral inner side, 45 degree the other side around on the outside. That means that something to begin with. Now, I think as an embryo, you start also with something. Let's say this is the egg. And then we let the whole system work and adapt according to the rules I just showed. And finally, you find the inner layers have a steep orientation, the outer layers become, the mid layers are about circumferentially oriented, and the outer layers have a steep angle just reversed. And part of it is also that when this occurs, if you look at motion, that the whole heart shows a torsional motion during each contraction. That's inherent to the helical pathways of these fiber orientations. This is in fact a result of our simulation. And then you look how... No, I didn't say that. I meant... diffusion tensor imaging. I think this is a picture of from our lab in Eindhoven, but I think many nice labs also know diffusion tensor imaging. It's a technique that works. And what you see here, in fact, you see this is in fact the angulation with this plane. That means blue means in plane, so this is a circumferential line, and here you can see that the papillary muscles are a kind of special structure with a very perpendicular structure inside, and around you have a kind of cylinder-like structure with helical fibers from circumferential, a little bit oblique, and this is red is 90 degree. This is the technique. This is the result. Four goat, anterior, interpapillary muscle, posterior, septum, from endo to epi. Look at fiber orientation, the helix angle, in fact. It goes from generally around 60, 70 degrees to minus practically 90 degrees. And as you can see, the red line is the prediction. And by the model, and these black dots all are data as measured in the goat by diffusion tensor imaging. And they may not be exactly the same, there are some differences anterior, posterior, but on the average, it's reasonable. So I think at that time, we saved a lot, because now for our model, we don't need to put all little angles all in between, because we just say uniformity of stress and adaptation, we start, we get this curve, and this curve we use in our modeling of the heart. So it is indeed an enormous parameter reduction. If it's correct, it's a secondary nice question. Furthermore, diameter of the heart we have measured, but what we have measured too, that is the imbrication angle. If you look on top of the heart, the fibers cross over from endo to epi. In the circumference in the middle, the imbrication angle or transverse angle is about zero. It follows the circumference. And if you are near the apex, the imbrication angle is opposite. And according to our model, it was this line. The dots were the measurements of imbrication transverse angle average over the circumference of a pig heart. And later we also have done it for goat heart, and that structure is quite much the same. I don't so. So what we think, the myofiber structure, with the proposed adaptation rules for the local tissue, we already get quite a realistic helical and transverse fiber structure where we can work with. So, in fact, still we haven't used any parameter for the fiber orientation. Sheet structure. Yeah, I was happy to have a sabbatical in San Diego. The weather was, it was hot. But, and all these animals in the sea, it's terrible. But, so I suffered the time, so most of the time I was working over there. And I enjoyed very much the cooperation with Andrew McCulloch and Kevin Costa. What you see here in the tissue, you have sheets about 4 cells thick. There are structures, layers of cardiac tissue. Sorry, this thickness. And they are separated by cleavage planes or sheets of loose connective tissue. You can see here some of these connective tissue strands. If you make a cut, you can see that at different depths from endo to epicardium, the sheet angles, show differences. What we thought is sheets, that was the hypothesis, sheets forms along lines where due to the deformation of the normal height, shear deformation is maximum. And according to mechanical engineering, it's known that the maximum shear direction occurs with an angle of 45 degrees with the maximum deformation direction. That means you have 2 solutions. Furthermore, and that I think that's reasonable, if you have a sheet structure, it should be in plane, let's say myofiber direction should be contained in the sheet plane. So that's an extra constraint. And in fact, what you are doing then is rotating the sheet plane until you find the direction of maximum shear, and then you define that, okay, I think along this orientation, you have the sheet orientation. Interesting thing is we did this with the model. And what you find, for instance, we had a deformation, one of these. Let's take this one. What it means is you look at plane, the cut, long axis plug cut radial. That means that it's a long axis cut. And then we looked at the sheet angle from epi to endo. These are, but the interesting thing is that, as already shown, you have 2 solutions, plus or minus 45 degrees. Now you have also the constraint that it should contain the fiber orientation, so it's not precisely separated by 45 degrees, and it's also in 3 dimensions, so you have to think a little bit. And we are thinking, how would we present that if at one value, there are 2 chances. So we made a Monte Carlo plot and said, okay, let's do this like a density plot, endo to epi sheet angle, and this is a kind of likelihood. Then I was looked into the data of Kevin Costa, and I was very happy about his marvelous documentation that within 3 months, I was able to deduct all these measurements and to reproduce what he did, and then I did some reanalysis on these data, and I still enjoy that very much, that someone leaves the stuff in a way that someone else can work with. So that was very good. And as you look now, if you look at one experiment, you didn't see really very much. But then we said, okay, let's pull all data. And then if you look now, on the distance, then you see that the prediction of the model and the pooled data have at least, let's say, some relationship.
He thought that's nice.
So maybe then sheet angles, okay, when we calculate deformation, then maybe we can also determine sheet angles, and that helps again a lot. In fact, if you make a cross-section of the heart, it would look a little bit like that. So this structure is known if you make a cross-section. And also there is another solution, and that depends a little bit on the distance of from base to apex where you are. And so there are two solutions of perpendicular sheets. It's known. So it's not too unrealistic. What you have to know about the function of sheets, in fact, Jim Covell already pointed out around the 70s, I think. He said, yeah, what is the idea of some sheets when you have a heart, and this is the thickness of the wall, when it shortens, it should be able to thicken. That's a high deformation. So then much deformation is lost, energy in deforming the tissue in a direction that in fact is not a contractile direction. So he pointed out that maybe there are some structures, restructuring possibilities, and I think that is kind of sheets. When these are shearing and you rotate a little bit, then you see that you can have enormous deformations with little deformation of the constitutive elements. So that, I think, is the role of the sheets. Interestingly, then, if this is the problem, to deform such a shape in such a shape, another solution does exactly the same. So sheet orientation might be either plus or minus at least two solutions. And in fact, it's not so important for the large scale model, because the sheets unload for shear stress. And as long as the shear stress is unloaded, and then the shear stress along this orientation is by definition equal to shear stress perpendicular to that direction, that means if shear stress here is zero, it's also zero here. If shear stress here is zero, it's zero there. So both conditions, in fact, have the same effect on the macroscopic deformation. So that means that when you make a model that we think it's quite soft, deformable in the cross-fiber direction. And this is a tissue this night I made it. Is it? Yeah, it looks like it was successful. I got it yesterday from Alistair. And as you can see, in the tissue you see here, these structures indeed, at certain locations, you have two solutions of the sheet orientation. So I think our thoughts are not too bad on that. Careful about time. So the sheet structure, say sheet plane, contain myofiber direction, and they are designed to facilitate cross-fiber deformation, thus minimizing channel stiffness. Application we have done is in an analysis of aortic stenosis. The idea behind that was, now back to the patient, so then you're thinking your models you can apply to the real world. When you have a heart with an aortic stenosis in the valve, then pressure is high over here, it's quite low over here. So the coronaries have problems in perfusing the myocardium, especially the inner layer, where the pressure is so high. And that means that the inner layers are lacking some metabolites of these oxygen cornea blood. At least they have larger chance to miss it. So the idea was, in patients with severe aortic stenosis, the inner layers do not contract well, and that has consequences for torsion. I get the wrong button. The idea behind that is, think about the wall of the heart. It has myofibers outside, white inside, yellow. When they shorten, the inner wall shortens more than the outer wall. Inner wall more shortened than the outer wall. By torsion, this diagonal lengthens and this diagonal shortens. So then you see that you can lengthen the inner fibers and shorten the outer fibers. If you add up and precisely compensate, then inner and outer fibers shorten by the same amount. That's optimal. That's fine. But what happens now if these fibers do not shorten that well? Then total shortening of the heart will decrease, but the torsion will increase, because normally the torsion is counteracted by these inner fibers. These inner fibers are gone, and you get more torsion. So if you divide torsion by shortening, you divide something that increases by something that decreases, so you are quite sure that it will really increase severely. That was the hypothesis. For that we used tagging. You believe tagging images, you have seen that many. There was a movie, but you have seen too many. So let's skip that. We can determine rotation on two layers. We can determine shortening, so we can determine the ratio of shortening over torsion. And we can make a graph out of it. This is one of the databases we use. This is effective mid-wall region, and our software made a motion of a heart of some of the students. Is this? I don't know which one. But we had a control group of healthy volunteers. We put as shortening as a function of torsion. Then it starts here at the beginning of ejection and it ends up over there. And as you can see, it's quite a linear relationship. And you can think about slope. And the slope is affect the ratio of torsion to shortening. So this is the normal shortening to torsion. And as you can see, if you take various individuals, they all have a very reproducible slope. It doesn't matter. So there's something in physiology that's very consistent. Aortic valve stenosis, then you see that the relation steepens. More shortening for the same amount of torsion. More torsion for the same amount of shortening. And there is a highly significant increase of this slope, even per patient. Not only for the group, but per patient. And we were so happy that some of these people, after replacement of the aortic valve, went again into the MRI machine, and as you can see, after 3 months, there is an improvement, more even distribution of work across the cardiac wall, more towards normal. We use that model from torsion to shortening to convert it to the ratio of inner to outer wall function. We use for that a measure transmural difference. That means that I look at the transmural difference and divide it by the average. So if function at the inner layer, endocardium is zero, no shortening, outer layer is 100%, the average is 50%, the difference is 100%, that means 2. If there is no transmural difference, the difference is zero. As you can see, the normal group is very narrow around zero. If you look at the aortic stenosis, then you see they all are highly significant, and even there is one patient which had no shortening of the inner layers at all. That severe was situation. But after aortic valve replacement, you could see that the whole situation improved. And in fact, this means that stunned subendocardial myofibers, myocardium, regains function somehow. So I think there is, you can say, probably there is some hibernation which has restored. Shortly I will go over that model, because now we are going thinking about circulation. I was talking now about structure and in fact how to fill this final element method with material and fiber orientations inside the heart. But then you need to have an environment of hemodynamics around your final element method. And in fact later we found out that circulation is also very interesting. What we did, in fact, is this is the basis of the model that I can show you. The left ventricle has a valve. It pumps into the aorta. It goes into the system of the left arteries system, the right veins, in the right atrium. From the right atrium, it goes through a valve, what is the right atrial valve to the ventricle. That means that's Trigger-Schmidt valve, I think. Quite sure about it. And then it goes into the left, to the right ventricle, and the right ventricle goes through the right artery, the pulmonary, in fact, and back round. And as you can see, some things to play around, because Tom Delhaas is a pediatric cardiologist, and you want to know what is the effect of the ductus, so that's also put in it. It's kind of, you feel a little bit like plumber. You put a number of these elements together, you can make what you want. For applications in pediatric cardiology, it's ideal. And all these elements have, in fact, a certain program. They have an electrical or flow, pressure flow property. One thing I want to point out is what is the relationship between the sarcomere and the pressure volume of a cavity. We all use the same, so for blood vessels and for atria and ventricles, we use the same relationship. It's all built up out of vessels, and you give properties to the stress-strain relation of the fibers. And these fibers are wrapped around the cavity. And in fact, the geometry of the cavity is not that critical. It's known that when you have an internal pressure and you know cavity volume divided by wall volume, and that is much the same as radius divided by wall thickness, then you get stress. That means, for instance, when wall volume is little, then you see that stress goes up, and that's precisely what's known. The only thing is that this equation appears to be valid for all shapes, not only circumferential, radial. In fact, it's determined by when I wrap fibers around the cavity, then this relationship is accurate. And also the strain, that means the sarcomere length, for instance, is related to the volume. And then you only have to use the data you know about the behavior of the sarcomere, which is a physiological principle, and then you get the pressure-volume relationship. What we did then, the laws of adaptation. The cavity, when contractility or diastolic stretch occurs, is initiating hypertrophy. When the deformation is too high, ejection fraction very high, or in fact fiber strain, then you get dilatation. The adaptation of the blood vessel is shear stress of flow determines the diameter, and wall stress determines wall thickness. That's our rules we put in the model. And then we said, now what is the number of models you add? After that, the number of parameters. Let's say a mean blood pressure. because some people have different. So it's a kind of patient-specific data you enter. Mean systemic blood flow, that is in this case 6 liters per minute. Mean heart rate, and blood pressure drop over the pulmonary circulation. And then you have to define the properties of what is the critical wall shear rate at which the blood vessels tend to make their diameter. Then you're thinking about the maximum wall stress for the blood vessels. That is too much explanation, but it's. And the exponential of wall material stiffness, that means how steep it increases with stretch. It's a nonlinearity. And the sarcomere has also properties of during exercise from 2.3 to 1.8 shortening micrometers. And isometric peak active stress is set at 93 kilopascal, which is derived from Hengtakur's data. And the passive stress maximum occurring is 4.8 kilopascal. If it's more, things break apart, the whole thigh starts dilating a little bit, or and then you get a readaptation that finally you end up that the passive stress in the material of the cardiac mass is that much. That's it. And if you put that in the model, then you get left and right ventricle. Now left ventricle increases, aortic pressure looks like that. And if you look at the atrial pressure over here, aortic volume flow, you see the shape is as you know. Mitral flow indeed has two bumps. That means an atrial contraction and early filling phase. And the right side effect is the same. And also at the beginning of this week, was Kovacs, he was telling that the total volume of the heart doesn't change. Now if you look here at the volume of the right ventricle, the left atrium, the right atrium, you add them up, you see they are in anti-phase, especially here, this is during exercise, and you can see that when you add it up, the volume is indeed quite constant. So you don't need an environment to encapsulate the heart to keep the volume constant because all these units are loose. No, it's just automatically coming out of this system by self-adaptation. That's it. Pressure volume loops during rest, left ventricle, right ventricle. And the atria is very interesting, of course, which is fast filling phase, do not have isovolumic contraction phases, but it works. You also get stresses and strains, that's nice, because you get the whole solution. So then you see stress-strain relationship, sarcomere length, in fact, here a micrometer versus kilopascal stress. And during exercise you can see the increase of stroke volume, frequency is also increased, and you get a larger loop. And especially the atria are working hard during exercise, while during rest the atria, they are practically non-contracting. Then in fact the early filling phase is the most important thing, that is the function of the atria. And and in fact, here you see all these parameters, what is the compliance of left and right atrium and so on. You get numbers, but that's not input, that's output. The parameters come out of the model. So that saves us a lot of parameters to be added in the program. Applications, we think, will be boundary condition finite element model of that, patient-specific modeling, and non-invasive catheterization, and then you should think about when I know the acceleration across the mitral valve, it says something about pressure difference across the mitral valve, and in fact something about pressures inside the left ventricle, and that you can do non-invasively because velocities you can measure with Doppler. This is a study where we used in fact these model results, but this is a dog. What was atrioventricular block? We looked at the pressure-volume relationships. We translated it into stress-strain relationships, and you get such loops. The interesting thing is when you have an atrial ventricular block, the heart rate goes down, and as a result, you get a higher stroke volume. The interesting thing is that peak stress during systole, even during atrial ventricular block, was about constant. You can see it on top. And that is strange. People always think when you have a low heart rate, the heart dilates, you get a thinner wall, so pressure, stress will increase. It does not. For us, this was a proof that stress, fiber stress, active could not be stimulus to hypertrophy. And if you look in literature, people still assume that a high stress during systole is a stimulus to hypertrophy. What's interesting is that the heart dilates. That means you get a high end-diastolic stress, and that closely relates to the mass increase per time. So this is affecting the growth of hypertrophy. And so we think that these simple models can help us a little bit in not testing yet, let's say, fooling around with hypotheses, and hope you will find once a hypothesis which is not true. But this time, we could not reject the fact that hypertrophy is caused by stretch of the passive matrix. Validation, I don't know what it is. A hypothesis you cannot validate. Not much time. So I go now very shortly through it, but it's a nice story. I like that. Adaptation rules with a deformation intervention. Yeah, we thought, okay, let's look at fiber orientation. Most people have a heart like this. Fibers are oriented like that. But one out of 8,000 people have changed the internal heart, liver, everything inside your body. It's called situs inversus totalis, or SIT, as I call it. And we thought, okay, then in that case, we expect that the torsion would be just opposite. And that's nice, because we have an MRI, so we put them in the MRI. Only first thing you have to do is to find one out of 8,000 people. okay. So we hired the MRI for 1 out of 8,000 of these people indeed were situs inversus. Now, honestly, Tom Delhaas, he was quite clever, and he found 14 not patients. Just 14 people who were inverted. He also said, okay, because these patients, they don't like to show their heart to the researcher. We want to have a situs inversus heart in our hands. So he went to the butchers and said, look for me if you can find one. And you got the price of 2,000 euro for the first one. This one is first situs inversus. As you can see here, this heart indeed is mirror imaged. Yep, this is the LAD, and left and right, you can now say pulmonary systemic. Left and right is of course not valid in this case. So we are working a little bit with these things, and what we thought torsion would be. Normal torsion would be minus 0.14, so we thought for the situs inversus it would be plus 14, but that's not true. When we looked at our first data, we couldn't believe it. We thought that this is an error, and human torsion normally is all layers. We had 5 slices, they all showed the same torsional behavior, but here, in fact, the apex had the normal torsion. The mid layers didn't have torsion, and the upper layers were inverted. It's a weird heart. That means that torsion was a kind of changing sign from apex to base. And that means that the motion is not like this one normally, but like you hold top and down and you rotate the center. So it's a completely different heart. The structure indeed is different, and how it differs, the torsion here I can see. We use our modeling expertise to find the fiber orientation in situs versus heart. We compared it with literature data, and again it was something that was similar. For instance, if you cut here deeper, all fibers tend to be parallel in the same direction. It's done here, deeper, the fiber orientation. It's the same. Normally the helix angle would have this, that behavior. So we felt comfortable with our ideas. And this is a drawing, and maybe someone wants to see how it's precisely, but in fact you should think, nested two hearts, a normal heart near the apex, an inverted heart near the base with other torsion, and the nice thing is that in the middle they can fit without a discontinuity in fiber orientation. And that is think that the structure of the situs inversus heart. So the situs inversus heart is really a different heart. Efficiency of this heart, and then it's over nearly, the efficiency of the heart, yeah. Each cell optimizes generation of mechanical work. All cells work close to the optimum. Since the only escape of mechanical work is pump work to the exterior, the situs inversus heart works just as optimal as the normal heart, only completely different structure. So if someone tells me your heart is designed optimum, I start laughing. Oh, I know another solution is also just as optimum, so then it's not optimum. At least two solutions. And you can get very old. It's known that a Vietnamese woman at that time had an age, she was the oldest woman at that time in that environment, was 113 years old and had a situs inversus. So you are not sick, you are not a patient. General conclusion I have is cell structuring by adaptation, and I mean by that I start with some beginning draft. If it's different, I got a different solution, for instance, situs inversus. I let adapt the tissue, the bricks, to the load, and as a result, I get structure. This idea works for cardiovascular modeling on all levels. Adaptation can be modeled in many cases, I think. This is just the beginning. And I think adaptation should be used as prior knowledge in heart modeling because it saves so many parameters.